You know, and the stuff of his is so bottomless that I'm excited to, you know, start where I am with it and then find out what's going to evolve and what's going to change.
Hello and welcome to The State of Shakespeare. I'm Garrett Vandermeer.
And I'm Jim Elliott.
And today we welcome Kelly Curran back to the program. Hello, Kelly.
Hi, it's nice to be with you guys again.
It's good to have you back. Now, we first spoke to Kelly in the fall. During our last conversation, we talked about Lady Percy from Henry IV, parts 1 and 2. But we did not release that interview because shortly after we recorded it, Kelly was cast to play the role in the upcoming production at the Shakespeare Theater Company in Washington, D.C. Kelly, congratulations and welcome back.
Thank you so much. It was such a wild turn of events to have a whole conversation with you guys about that character and just how much I adore her. And then to get a phone call that someone wants me to come play her was just a really marvelous thing to have happen.
I feel that we're partly responsible for you getting that role.
It was some sort of like magical, you know, you guys just put it out into the airwaves and, you know, these productions, we're doing Henry IV parts 1 and 2 in repertory, as you mentioned. So I get to sort of live with her for 6 months, which is so exciting to be able to have that much time living with these plays and these characters.
When we spoke to you, Lady Percy was someone who was on your mind, but had you ever played the role before?
I did a summer with the British American Dramatic Academy at Oxford, and Floyd King was one of my Shakespeare teachers, and Floyd King is actually a longtime company member of the Shakespeare Theater Company here in D.C., and he assigned me the Lady Percy monologue from Henry IV Part 2, and that was the first time I ever got to work on her. I think I was 18 years old, and I just fell so fast in love with her. And then a couple of years later, when I did the Public Theater Shakespeare Lab, Janet Zarish assigned me the Hotspur Kate scene from Part 1. And so I've gotten to work on her in bits and pieces in all sorts of different forms, but never fully play the role and get the full trajectory of Part 1 and Part 2. So this is sort of a great culmination of all this work that I've done on her over the past 10 years as a student and otherwise.
Amazing.
Speaking of your work over the past 10 years, a brief introduction to Kelly Curran for our listeners. Kelly is a leading lady at the very top of her game, and her resume reads like a wish list of outstanding American theater companies. Kelly has worked at the Labyrinth Theater, the Signature Theater, 59 East 59th, the Acting Company, Portland Center Stage, Shakespeare and Company, the Guthrie, Alabama Shakespeare Festival.
And on and on and on.
And on and on and on. Kelly, you're far too young to have so many feathers in your cap already. To what do you attribute your early success as a Shakespearean actor?
You know, I got introduced to Shakespeare as a playwright in high school, and I had this wonderful drama teacher in high school who had actually trained some at Shakespeare and Company, and he just really turned me on to the work and the language. And I felt like when I started reading it and starting understanding it more and more, something just clicked. I've always sort of been guided by my love for language, but especially him as an author.
You're living it right now, because now you're absolutely in the thick of it. And tackling Lady Percy is taking on one of the most beloved female roles in the entire Shakespeare canon, although she has very little time on stage, doesn't she?
She does. You know, it's so funny because I've already, you know, we've only been in rehearsal for a week and I've already had lots of time off. Essentially, over the course of both plays, she really only appears in about 3 scenes. But I think there's something about her directness and her boldness that is just unforgettable. I mean, she's just one of those characters that comes in, and when she speaks with such courage that I think she's hard to forget. She makes quite the impression. She did on me, at least, but I think she probably does that to everybody.
Kelly, I actually have a quick question. Since you've been in rehearsal for a week, have you learned anything new, or have you made any discoveries about her since our last conversation?
A bit. I mean, it's been so great to jump in and understand how the people on the artistic team view her. I got to see the renderings of my costume, and our costume designer described her as really a warrior in her own right. And I loved the way she did that, because it's, you know, the female presence in this play is, I think, the smallest in almost any of his plays, and certainly any of the histories. And so the fact that she, despite being in so little of the actual play, she can come across as a character of that strength, that she really holds her own in a world that's very much a man's world. We also got this phenomenal dramaturgical packet, this thick packet of all this information, and that's been exciting to discover, you know, the history of who the Percys actually were. And really how powerful, what a powerful family they were in England at the time. A family with an incredible breadth of military experience just based on their location and sort of the territory that they constantly had to be guarding.
So you've just completed your first week of rehearsal at the Shakespeare Theater Company in Washington, D.C. You're being directed by Michael Kahn. Take us through the first week of rehearsals. What's it like?
Oh my gosh, it's so exciting. You know, we walked in on the first day and we had sort of meet and greet where everybody in the company arrives and introduces themselves. And I've never seen more people at a meet and greet in my life. The cast alone is the largest cast I've ever worked with professionally. There are 31 of us. And so by the end of the first day, I hadn't even had the opportunity to physically introduce myself to every cast member. It took about 2 days just to meet every member of the cast.
Well, so many of them are dying off. Psycho.
So it was so exciting just thinking of like the scope of the production and the size of it. And we've already read through both plays, parts one and part two, and table works all of part one, and then return to it to read through it again at the end of last week. And this week we're beginning table work with part two to sit down and really go through the play scene by scene. And then we'll get up on our feet probably by the middle of this week.
For our listeners who may not be familiar with the term, what is table work?
Before you get up on your feet and start physically finding the shape of the play, the table work period is the period usually at the beginning of a rehearsal process where the actors and the creative team sit around the table with text in hand and books and resource material and just kind of parse out the scenes, you know, moment to moment, and talk about the history of these characters perhaps, or the things in the text that illuminate the architecture of the scene. And so it's really just an opportunity to figure out the world of the play very specifically, moment to moment. And it's a really nice opportunity to just have some really thorough conversations about character and journey and the text.
I love table work. I feel like this is what we do on the State of Shakespeare.
Yeah,
it's sort of a table work for the air.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's like you start these conversations, and if there wasn't a stage manager there to tell you you have to take a 10-minute break now, I mean, they could go on for hours. With this particular company, you know, there are some artistic fellows who are non-equity actors who are here earning their equity card, and then there's mid-career actors, and then there's also this band of older actors that have been working for some of them upwards of 30 years. And so the breadth of experience of the ensemble is so enormous and so thrilling to all be in the same room talking about this.
It must be so exciting to listen or watch an actor who has 30 years of experience watch their process.
Oh my gosh, absolutely. I mean, some of these actors, you know, I watch them just read from the script sitting at the table, and it's like they can raise an eyebrow and you are captivated. I mean, the language comes to them so effortlessly that it's just amazing to watch, much less work with. It's really pretty thrilling.
You've chosen two speeches from Henry IV, both part one and two.
Fantastic speeches. I mean, some of the best material, you know, he wrote for young women especially. And the first time we meet her in act two, scene three of part one, she's approaching her husband. It's late at night. I think we get the sense that it's either very late at night or very early in the morning. And her husband isn't in bed, and he hasn't come to bed in weeks, and she basically knows that something is going on and he's not telling her, and she's worried, and she comes to speak to him, and it's this really fantastic scene between the two of them that I think really illuminates the intimacy of their marriage. And they're both just really remarkable speeches that, you know, in the course of these three scenes with her, I think you get an incredible sense of the depth of love that existed in their marriage.
I'd love to hear them.
Yeah, absolutely. No problem. Oh, my good Lord, why are you thus alone? For what offense have I this fortnight been a banished woman from my Harry's bed? Tell me, sweet Lord, what is that takes from thee thy stomach, pleasure, and thy golden sleep? Why dost thou bend thine eyes upon the earth and start so often when thou sitst alone? Why hast thou lost the fresh blood in thy cheeks and given my treasures and my rights of thee to thick-eyed musing and cursed melancholy? In thy faint slumbers I by thee have watched and heard thee murmur tales of iron wars, speak terms of manage to thy bounding steed, cry courage to the field, and thou hast talked of sallies and retires, of trenches, tents, of frontiers, cannon, and of parapets, of prisoners' ransom, and soldiers slain, and all the currents of a heady fight. Thy spirit within thee hath been so at war, and thus has so bestirred thee in thy sleep, that beads of sweat have stood upon thy brow, like bubbles in a late disturbed stream. And in thy face strange motions have appeared, such as we see when men restrain their breath on some great sudden hest. Oh, what portents are these? Some heavy business hath my lord in hand, and I must know it, else he loves me not.
Thank you, Kelly.
Thanks, Kelly.
Of course.
So easy, so simple.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's a start, you know? I mean, that's what's exciting, is to be so familiar with the speech because I've enjoyed it for so long and studied it for so long, and then to have the opportunity to spend the next 6 months working on it. What it will be like having the actor who's playing my husband right there with me for the whole thing.
Kelly, speaking strictly technically, your reading is so precise and so clearly articulated. I adore your alacrity with the plosives, the consonants, especially the ending consonants. Are you aware of that as you read and perform, or is that something that's become ingrained?
I think it's something that's probably become ingrained in me. I mean, I've been lucky enough to have some remarkable voice teachers. And when you start to study with these people who really illuminate how the language can really give you clues as to who this person is, based on the type of language they use and the types of phrases that they coin and come up with and create. And that has sort of become ingrained, as now I can, so many years after working on his text, I can come to the character with that somewhere already in my mind and in my heart, that these people use language very specifically. And that's a gift to an actor.
When you read Lady Percy, she comes across as extremely intelligent and very much in control of her emotions. And a lot of that has to do with your precision with the text.
Oh, thank you. That's funny. I hadn't thought of it that way, because I think, you know, approaching the text as an actor, I think about her and her marriage and her history and what she's like. And, you know, I always think she really is this woman, you know, like I've mentioned, holding her own in a man's world. And she's good at it.
This is also a woman who very much owns her sexuality. And there's one line, you deliver it so beautifully, that really nails that home for me. And in our version, it's line 46, which begins, "And given my treasures."
Mm-hmm.
And the way that you finish that line leaves no doubt about exactly what you're referring to.
Right.
Kelly, you set it up with the word pleasure, which obviously rhymes with treasure and is a little earlier, but you spin both of those in such a way that Garrett's point is very true.
I'd love to hear just that line again.
Can I start at the line before that?
Like, absolutely.
Why hast thou lost the fresh blood in my cheeks, and given my treasures and my rights of thee to thick-eyed musing and cursed melancholy?
Rights of thee. Oh, yeah. My God. That is
pretty spectacular, isn't it? I mean, you know, she really wields her own authority in all sorts of different ways.
Well, what I love about that opening is that there are five questions in a row.
Yeah.
They're questions, and yet...
Well, before we go on to that, Jim, I have to talk more about the sex.
Okay.
Kelly, you are Linklater trained.
Yes.
And Kristen Linklater talks about the vowel ladder, and the long E vowel is relatively high up on the vowel ladder. But on that line, you take that long E sound at the very end of the line into a very different register.
Yeah, it's so funny. I was just talking to my best friend about this. You know, I have this tendency in everyday life, you know, when I really feel strongly about something, my voice tends to drop like 3 octaves. It's so funny, but it just gets lower and lower. And I found that useful to discover when I think about characters that I'm creating too. And I think there's something about the more strongly I know my feelings about something, the more assured I am in what I'm saying, the lower my voice tends to get. And I think this woman is very assured in what she's saying, you know, frequently. So I think that's where she just falls with me naturally. Like when I start working on her, that's just sort of the register that she tends to live in. She's a little bit lower in the voice for me than maybe other characters have been in the past or will be in the future even.
You're not only asking questions, but you're delivering information. Are they rhetorical, or are you actually asking those questions?
You know, I always think it can tend to be a little more interesting to me as an actor if I start with asking the questions in earnest and hoping for an answer. I mean, she's trying to get information from him and he's not giving it to her. So she just keeps posing these questions. She's sort of unrelenting. She's used to living in a military family and she knows what honor means to her husband. And she's seeing behavior in him that she's never seen before. So something about these particular circumstances is remarkable and she needs to find out what it is. So I do think that these questions are in earnest.
I love it. I just want to point out there's an increasing intensity to the questions that you're asking.
Yeah, I think so. I think so because I think, you know, there are all sorts of ways these questions could be delivered and all sorts of tactics she's taking to get this information. You know, the options are almost unlimited, which is going to be exciting to explore over the next few months. She does start. The second question is, for what offense have I this fortnight been a banished woman from my Harry's bed? And we were talking about that in the table work with Michael and with John Keebler, who's the actor playing Hotspur. And Michael was saying, you know, what do you think that implies? Do you think that implies that they're not sleeping in the same room? Do you think that implies that he's not, do you think he's refusing to sleep with her? What do you think is going on? And you know, my intuition tells me that they have a great sex life. So it's probably really odd that for 2 weeks, they just haven't been sleeping together. And that was where the scene starts. That's where the speech starts. You know, she just immediately starts talking about it. It's so contemporary, you know, it's mm-hmm. so she's so direct with him and she's not ashamed of it. And, you know, the fact that she says my rights of thee, that she understands as his wife and as his partner, what that means and what kind of authority she has as his wife.
It brings to mind perhaps a pitfall, and maybe you have some advice for young actors playing this role. I think this would be a very popular audition speech. You, of course, when you play this role on stage, will have a wonderful Hotspur to play against. But yeah. In a vacuum, to your point about whether you're asking for, whether these questions, these repeated questions, you're waiting for a response, how would you guide a young actor who is auditioning with this part and doesn't have a partner to play against?
I think it's an incredibly difficult audition scene because it's such a partnership between them. And I think, you know, if you have to audition with it, I do think you have to fight the urge to just speed through everything. I think you have to create him in your mind and really see him and take the time to imagine his sort of physical response to everything you're asking and what might hit home for him and what might not. I think you really do have to create an image of who this person is to you so that you don't just kind of rush through the speech and it doesn't become like a tirade of questions.
I absolutely agree. And one of the things I say to young students working on monologues is that it's not a soliloquy. It's a dialogue. It's just that the other person is not speaking.
Yes. And you have to really assume that they might answer. He might answer one of those questions at any given moment. He just doesn't.
Right.
So you go, you know, but I think you have to hear that she's hoping he'll open his mouth and say something and it'll be the truth and it'll be what she wants to hear.
Yeah. And what does he say at the end of the speech? But what ho is Gilliam's with the packet gone? I mean,
he completely ignores her at the end of the speech.
She gets nothing.
She gets nothing. But you know what? I kind of love that because I think he has to because I think he knows he can't keep things from her. I think she's such a persuasive, she makes such persuasive arguments and they are so close that I think it's probably profoundly difficult for him to keep things from her. And so he has to just break away and start ordering people around.
We're speaking with Kelly Curran, who's playing Lady Percy roles in Henry IV, Part 1 and 2 at the Shakespeare Theater Company in Washington, D.C., For your second speech, Kelly, you chose the speech from Henry IV, Part 2, Act 2, Scene 3. Can you give us a little background on what's happening?
Yes. So what has happened is at the conclusion of Part 1, and this is a spoiler alert in case anyone wants to stop listening right now, but at the conclusion of Part 1 in the Battle of Shrewsbury, her husband, Hotspur, is killed. And at the beginning of Part 2, her father-in-law is about to join the rebels after he's lost his son and fight with them. And the tricky thing about this story is that he was supposed to join his son at the Battle of Shrewsbury and he fell ill and he didn't come and he didn't send his troops in support without him. So now that he's lost his son, I think there's a tremendous amount of guilt that he's feeling and he's about to go sort of fight in his name and finish the battle that his son started. And Lady Percy doesn't want him to. I think at this point, she's already lost one incredibly important person in her life. And I think she's pretty unwilling to lose another.
And what does she say?
Oh, yet for God's sake, go not to these wars. The time was, Father, that you broke your word when you were more endeared to it than now. When your own Percy, when my heart's dear Harry threw many a northward look to see his father bring up his powers, but he did long in vain. Who then persuaded you to stay at home? There were two honors lost, yours and your son's. For yours, the God of heaven brighten it. For his, it stuck upon him as the sun in the gray vault of heaven. And by his light did all the chivalry of England move to do brave acts. He was indeed the glass wherein the noble youth did dress themselves. He had no legs that practiced not his gait, and speaking thick, which nature made his blemish, became the accents of the valiant. For those that could speak low and tardily would turn their own perfection to abuse, to seem like him, so that in speech, in gait, in diet, in affections of delight, in military rules, humors of blood, he was the mark and glass, copy and book that fashioned others, and him, oh, wondrous him, oh, miracle of men, him did you leave. Second to none, unseconded by you, to look upon the hideous god of war in disadvantage, to abide a field where nothing but the sound of Hotspur's name did seem defensible, so you left him. Never, oh, never do his ghost the wrong to hold your honor more precise and nice with others than with him. Let them alone. The marshal and the archbishop are strong. Had my sweet Harry had but half their numbers, today might I, hanging on Hotspur's neck, have talked of Monmouth's grave.
Oh, lovely.
Devastating.
Wow.
Oh, it's an incredible speech, because I don't even think she realizes she's going to launch into this whole thing about him. And you just get the sense that it just starts to come out of her. And she has to find her way to keep making the argument, because I don't think she intends to start the speech as an ode to him, but she just can't help it.
Oh, I have to be effusive about this for a minute. Even just listening to you and not seeing you, it's a devastating speech. Mm-hmm. And Kelly, you're such a pro. And it's so nice to hear the clarity of the words. I think that so many young actors will fall prey to the emotion and being overwhelmed by it. And a tremor in the voice might begin to appear. And yet, every word is crystal clear. You're completely in command. And yet, we feel so much for your loss. It's a really remarkable read. Thank you.
Just that moment with precise and nice was just beautiful.
I love that combination at the end of the speech when she says precise and nice. I mean, there's such specific words. And
so disdainful.
Oh, so disdainful. She is so angry, right? I mean, there's that thing about grief that it can manifest as such anger, that injustice of losing someone. And she, I think that comes out in this speech in incredible ways. And she's still making her argument the whole way through. I mean, that's the thing. It's this like remarkable ode to this man. And when she says, oh, wondrous him, oh, miracle of men. I mean, it's an incredible phrase. Mm. It just gorgeous phrase about describing, you know, the love of her life, but she still has an argument to make. And that's, I think, the most incredible things about her as a character is she's going through this tremendous grief, but she is not overwhelmed by it yet to the point where she can't make this speech and she can't try to get what she wants. She really is a warrior in her own way.
That is crystal clear in your reading, Kelly.
In what you do.
It's all these things, but it's a eulogy for Hotspur, but it doesn't stop there. And it's a shaming of his father. You never in your reading lose sight of what she wants to do with the speech, why she shames him.
Right. I mean, it's so amazing. I mean, there's so much love in the speech. It's this speech about grief and loss and rage. And there is so much sheer love in it. I think that's the force of will behind the speech. It's so remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, just again, to point out something that you did that was just so lovely was how the last two lines you made so clear in working the antithesis there.
Yeah. All those H's and like the openness of that, the hanging on Hotspur's neck. I mean, it's such a gift to an actor to have those open vowels and all those H's. I mean, it just, you just feel it. You feel what that would be like in the combination of those letters, you know? It's so great.
The previous speech was definitely a private speech. Is this speech private or public?
Well, you know, this speech is to her father-in-law, and her mother-in-law is also in the room. And I think, you know, it's potentially up to the director and his vision of it, whether or not there is a whole group of other leaders or servants or, you know, members of this household in the room. And I think it really could go either way. I think it could be a private conversation between family members, or it could be he's about to leave for the war and there's a whole train of people in the room preparing him for that, and she has to have the courage to say this in front of all of them.
The way you read it, I thought you were reading it with other people in the room.
She's talking to her father-in-law, and her father-in-law is a very powerful man, and she goes ahead with everything she has to say anyway. And if she has to do it in front of a lot of people, I mean, that might require even more courage. No matter how you set it, I think there's sort of discoveries to be mined out of each scenario.
Absolutely.
Kelly Curran will be taking on the role of Lady Percy in Henry IV, Part 1 and 2, playing in rep at the Shakespeare Theatre Company, coming this spring. The shows open on March 25th and run through June 7th. Kelly, thank you so much for joining us today on The State of Shakespeare.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure talking to you.
Oh, Kelly, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Garrett Vandermeer.
And I'm Jim Elliott.
And thank you for listening.
Thanks for joining us for the State of Shakespeare podcast. We invite you to visit stateofshakespeare.com for more episodes, information about each of our guests, and the Shakespeare text you heard on the program, and much more. And we welcome you to join the discussion by liking us on Facebook. That's www.stateofshakespeare.com. Thanks for listening.